Moseley's Black Shirts, the Suffolk landowner. My family, originating in a lordship between Dieppe and Rouen, held extensive lands in Norfolk from the beginning of the 13th century, and right up to 1931 had an interest in more than 80 farms in Norfolk and Suffolk. Until his death on the 19th of May 1954, my father lived at Monk Soham Hall, Woodbridge, Suffolk. He liked his walks in the early morning. From my bedroom window, I would watch his lone figure in the distance, appearing and disappearing over the inclines and declines of the property. Sometimes I would go out to meet him, and we would converse at length on politics, ethnology, and general philosophy. My father encouraged me, from an early age, to take responsibility, enjoy sporting activities, and adopt an individual and independent attitude. Thus, I frequently went off to London and other great cities to seek the company and learn from the erudite and enlightened. During the day, I spent my time with some social coterie, and at night, I visited the destitute and deprived remnants of society. Associating with the two nations enabled me to gain a balanced judgment in the distressful days of the 30s. Wealth and poverty, ostentation and deprivation, much that I saw alarmed and distressed me, the heedless vulgarity on the one side and the sordidness on the other. Inequality there must be, but this was pitiless inequality. In contrast with the festering cities, the countryside was at least clean and its poverty bearable. The lot of landowners and farmers had been a testing struggle even before the First World War. All around, land fell into neglect and farmsteads into a shambles of decay. In 1933, my father was offered virtually the whole of a village, which the church commissioners had seized as a tithe debt, on condition that he paid the arrears which had been owing for some 5 years. My father could well have done so, but he refused, and no one else would accept the bait. The land lay dormant, right up to the outbreak of war in 1939. Overgrown with weeds, it was a scene of utter desolation. Many farmers over a wide surrounding area were in debt to my father, and I would drive him around to visit them. His sympathetic generosity, extended at considerable financial loss to himself, enabled some of them to survive to better days. Up to the age of 21, I was fully occupied with work, sport, and study. Philosophy attracted me more than history, which I considered one-sided and unreasoning. I conceived my own philosophy as Darwinian pantheism. The aim of one's transient life, I decided, should be to give more than one takes. In 1930, I took over the full occupation, responsibility for, and use of Cranley Manor on the outskirts of the small borough town of Eye. Later, I inherited this property. As a man who was never less alone than when alone, this arrangement suited me splendidly. My reading and studying could continue without interruption, while my personal household wants were provided by a thoughtful housekeeper and her husband, to both of whom I have ever since been indebted. I married in 1933. My capable and gifted wife has shared with fortitude and understanding the long struggle for our beliefs and our aims. Social life, with its at-homes, leaving of visiting cards, and stultifying gatherings, was never my forte. I regarded the social round as empty, shallow, backbiting, and insular. Though a member of an old, established, traditional conservative family, I felt that the Conservative Party had conserved only for a privileged few, and that its policies had reduced the majority of our people to misery and poverty. For several years, I read, pondered, and observed, and expressed my views in contentious letters to the press. In response to one of these letters, I one day received a parcel containing some of Sir Oswald Mosley's writings and literature, explaining the policies of his movement. After 2 months' deliberation, I decided that Mosley was right, and that henceforth I would join his movement and work for its cause. It was obvious to me that British agriculture and industry were being sacrificed for the sole benefit of international financiers who reaped a higher rate of interest on their investments in low-paid sweatshop countries, and that in consequence cheap food and manufactured goods flooded into Britain to the detriment of our industries and our workers. This financial trickery was being exposed by a selfless, fearless man of outstanding intellectual gifts and total sincerity. This man was no posturing demagogue, but a far-sighted patriot. The local BUF branch organiser arranged a personal interview with Mosley at my request and travelled up to London with me. When I entered Mosley's office, he arose and we shook hands firmly. We looked at each other straight, and I immediately felt that there was a complete mutual understanding between us that required no words to express. On that same day, I had tea with another leading member of considerable character and ability, A. Raven Thompson. Soon, I was responsible for my own branch in the I Parliamentary District. With the aid of strong-minded and reliable deputy leaders, we held regular meetings, selling our newspapers on the streets and delivering them to remote country houses. Communists from nearby Leeston came over to heckle and attack us, and when I attended London meetings, it was noticeable that it was the communists who had organised the violence. In 1938, I stood for election to the I Borough Council as local leader of the BUF. Though I had undertaken little canvassing, I was voted onto the council, making my speech on the town hall steps, and attended the council's meetings thereafter. Shortly after my election, I received a letter from Mosley, in which he said, "I write to congratulate you very warmly on your success, and to thank you for the signal service you have performed for the movement by your fight." At a council meeting, with opposition from only one councillor, I succeeded in securing the I Town Hall for a meeting to be addressed by Mosley. On the day of the meeting, I arranged for loudspeakers to be attached to the four outside walls of the Town Hall so that Mosley's speech could be relayed to an outside audience and heard by most people in the borough. Sir Oswald and his party arrived at my house at about 6:30 p.m. to dine with my wife and myself before proceeding to the meeting, which was due to start at 8 p.m. At 7:45 p.m. we went for a short stroll across my lawns and around my garden and became engrossed in a discussion on philosophy and philosophers, on country law and kindred subjects. Deeply immersed, we suddenly heard the town hall clock strike 8 p.m. a mile away in the valley. Mosley had never been known to be late for a meeting. We hastily jumped into a car and arrived at the town hall a minute or two late, entering by a side door. Outside, the square and streets were crowded. Some imported communists waited, obviously intent on creating a disturbance. Inside, the hall was packed with a well-mannered audience who listened attentively to Sir Oswald's speech. After Mosley had finished, I made a brief speech against the din made by the communist opposition outside and the stones and the brickbats thrown by them at the back wall behind the speaker's platform. Returning to my house that night, I arranged a private meeting of my members, who had been heartened by the enthusiasm shown at the town hall meeting. As well as increased support after Mosley's appearance in I, we met with increased opposition. This I found encouraging. We held more public and private meetings and sold our newspapers in the streets of Norwich, Ipswich, and the towns and villages of my parliamentary area. Our membership increased week by week, even though I would accept only the best and most trustworthy applicants, for I regarded the recruitment of persons of character, courage and reliability as being essential to the success of our struggle. By 1939, it was clear that a great many people were beginning to rebel against the hopelessness and decay of the old political order. In the countryside, first-class medium loam farms could be bought for less than £4 an acre, while in the towns, whole industries were collapsing under the competition of cheap imported goods. Contrary to popular mythology, in the late 1930s, the British people were turning to Mosley and his policy of economic sanity in rapidly growing numbers. Then came an unnecessary war, which lay waste the whole of Europe and cost millions of lives. Britain could have gotten accommodation with the have-not powers, which would have made Europe and its overseas territories invulnerable, self-sustaining, and subservient to neither Russia nor America. For 9 months, after Britain's ridiculous and worthless guarantee to Poland and declaration of war, we of the BUF continued to advocate an honourable negotiated peace. Then, in the late spring of 1940, the infamous Regulation 18B was used to silence us. Hundreds of true patriots were seized in their homes and at their workplaces and thrown into prison without charge or trial. There, we were treated worse than convicted criminals and subjected to every indignity and degradation. Many of us who were confined in Walton Jail, Liverpool, spent 23.5 hours a day in solitary confinement, being allowed only half an hour's exercise a day in the prison courtyard. Compelled to walk apart, we were not allowed to speak to one another. The only sound was the tramping of feet and an occasional warning shout from a warder if he detected a whispered voice. Nightly, the Luftwaffe bombed the Liverpool docks, and one night there was a direct hit on the prison. In due course, we were moved to concentration camps, such as the one at Ascot. Here, a heavy double-barbed wire enclosure was flanked by machine gun turrets, and revolver and rifle-equipped guards patrolled the perimeter night and day. It was both pathetic and amusing, but nevertheless part of an enormous tragedy, the needless self-destruction of the West. The concentration camps provided us with some relief. We could mix and converse with the colourful melange of detainees from all walks of life. Some had arrived from Brixton Prison, where Mosley was held, and it strengthened our hearts to learn that he was well and undaunted in spirit. Our contingent from Walton contained Catholic priests and Protestant clergymen, well-known authors, university dons, large estate owners, farmers, farm workers, doctors, accountants, retired pensioners in their 70s, and naval, air force and army officers, some still in uniform. All had been torn from their homes, wives, children, employees and places of work, without being able to arrange for their dependents' security or welfare. Empty homes and shops were robbed. For many, it was a calamity from which they were never able to recover. Eventually, I appeared before the government's secret tribunal. My inquisitors asked me what I had meant in a public declaration at the time Britain declared war, that all was lost. What was indeed lost to Britain, Europe, and the West was far greater than any of us could possibly have imagined at that time. After my release from Ascot concentration camp, armed guards accompanied me to Ascot railway station. I was given a warrant to take me home. My identity card was returned to me, endorsed in red, to the effect that I was forbidden to move more than 5 miles from my home without the permission of the Chief Constable of Suffolk. A letter signed by the Secretary of State confirmed this. What an insult and a farce it all was. Fortunately for me, my local police and chief constable were understanding. They allowed me some elasticity, and I owe them much gratitude. After the war ended, when Churchill stole from Mosley his idea of a united Europe, I received a letter signed by Churchill, asking me to give him my backing. I wrote to him, saying that he now expected us to support that which he had done more than anyone to destroy. In my heavily locked prison cell, 6 foot by 12, in which the days were measured only by alternating light and dark, I philosophized ruefully on the mysterious nature of man and the devious ways in which he enacts his laws. We of the British Union of Fascists said and did what we believed to be right, and I am sure that in time truth will expose the falsity that denounced us. Indeed, the process of historical correction and rethinking has already begun. In my study, piled high with books, many written by old and valued friends, is one of my proudest possessions, a large framed photograph of Sir Oswald Mosley, on which he had written on the 11th of November, 1965, to my old friend and companion, Ronald Creasy, from Mosley. Serious-minded people frequently ask me, how did Mosley feel in the last years of his life? I can only answer that his mind was completely at peace. Jonathan Swift, compelled to go into exile to Dublin to escape his political enemies, once wrote, "When a true genius appears in the world, you may know him by this sign, that all the dunces are in confederacy against him." Mosley could afford a tranquil mind. He had taken no part in the destruction of Britain and Europe. Unlike Swift, Mosley went into exile voluntarily to help make Europe, for he felt that it was still possible for Britain to recapture some of its old glory as an equal partner in a great new European nation, a power capable of withstanding all outside threats. To his last hour, Mosley remained centuries ahead of the jealous and spiteful dunces who oppressed him and denigrated his noble vision and his burning patriotism. Shortly before his death, I met him for the last time at a gathering in London. No matter that our conversation was brief, he had others to see and greet. We clasped hands warmly, and our eyes met in the same totality of understanding that we had experienced so many years before. In my heart, there was deep sorrow, for I felt the chiming of the hour. We had written to one another about Oswald Spengler's philosophy, with which Mosley at first disagreed, but later largely accepted. The hour of decision was clearly approaching for this man of supreme distinction and undying spirit. Those of us who followed him may well feel that we too can depart this life in equal serenity and peace. By R. N. Creasy.
Tuned in to Radio Stormer on the DailyStormer.com.
Mosley's Black Shirts, the North London manufacturer. In 1934, as a 16-year-old apprentice cabinet maker, I spent many of my lunch hours in Finsbury pavement, listening to the various political speakers as I munched my sandwiches. It was the black shirt speakers who interested me most, men like Patrick Moi and Jock Holywell, who offered what seemed like a clearly stated and easily understood solution to the enormous problems of unemployment and grinding poverty. If the effort that had gone into war was applied in peace, these problems would soon disappear. Their message was that simple. Despite much heckling, these meetings were generally orderly. My father had been gassed during the First World War, and during the 1920s we lived in two rooms at the top of a three-story tenement in a poor neighbourhood. But my brother and I were a lot luckier than most of our schoolmates. Our father was a yard foreman with Shelmex, earning £3 a week, while our mother had a part-time job as a cook. In 1936, as an unemployed cabinet maker, I joined the British Union of Fascists Shoreditch branch in Newton Grove. The local organiser was Duke Sutherland. My father had always been a strong supporter of the Labour Party, but the bitter political differences that then divided many families did not split ours, for the reason that my father combined quite an admiration for Mosley with an intense dislike of Bolshies. Eventually, the years of violent coughing caused by wartime gassing took its toll. Father died at the early age of 52, just after Dunkirk. I was a very active member of the BUF, right from joining, attending most regional events and many national ones. During the Spanish Civil War, I and other blackshirts stewarded meetings held by the Friends of National Spain at the Caxton Hall and elsewhere. I spent a good deal of my time selling our party papers on the streets, but there were plenty of other journals that expressed similar viewpoints for us to read. The Patriot was a political weekly to which some of our members contributed articles and letters. Its readers tended to be people who believed in conspiracy theories, truth. Motto, cultivators of truth, enemies of fraud, had an influential readership and could be relied on to expose not only business frauds, but left-wing cant and humbug. G.K. Chesterton had for many years advocated the widest possible ownership of property through distributism, publicising such ideas in GK's Weekly, which, following his death, was incorporated into the Weekly Review. The New English Weekly, published between April 1932 and September 1949, supported social credit, but was also quite sympathetic to us. Its editor, A.R. Orage, had made The New Age the outstanding literary review before the 1914 war. The Saturday Review, whose contributors included Max Beerbohm and Bernard Shaw, and which was owned by Lady Houston, published articles about Mosley. The Criterion, the famous literary review, founded and edited by T.S. Eliot and published between 1922 and 1939, was definitely sympathetic to us. Mosley wrote for the National Review and the Quarterly Review. Among imported periodicals available to us was the American weekly newspaper, Social Justice, published by Father Charles Coughlin, the famous Detroit Catholic priest and radio broadcaster who had founded the National Union for Social Justice. We were influenced in our thinking by the writings of Hilary Belloc, especially by the prophecies and warnings contained in his books The Party System and The Servile State. Hilary Belloc did not join or support our movement, but a number of other famous authors did. Major Francis Yeats Brown had served in the cavalry on the northwest frontier of India before the First World War and was a prisoner of the Turks from 1915 to 1918, an experience he described vividly in his first book. For 3 years, he was assistant editor of The Spectator, and in 1930 he published his most famous book, Bengal Lancer, a partly autobiographical work. In 1934 he wrote Dogs of War, a refutation of pacifism. Dawnford Yates, or Major C. W. Mercer, had been called to the bar in 1909, and in the following year took part in the Old Bailey trial of Dr. Crippen. He served in Egypt in the First World War. Starting with Berry and Company, his slightly farcical novels became very popular, and their sales ran into millions. Dawnford Yates had no sympathy with the drab, democratic, and mechanized world of the 20th century, and his novels were designed to bring back a degree of romance into dull lives. The BUF's most distinguished man of letters was Henry Williamson, who had served as a private in the First World War and who shared Moseley's disillusionment. Williamson made his literary reputation with his four-volume autobiography, The Flax of Dreams. His most famous and successful book, Tarka the Otter, won him the Hawthornden Prize. Among his better-known books was The Story of a Norfolk Farm. Williamson's political views were expressed openly in his books. Apart from authors, such entertainers as Harry Champion of Any Old Iron fame and the radio humorist Jilly Potter belonged to our movement. We were also strong in musicians, Cuthbert Reevely being our director of music and G.S. Merriman, the organist at Salisbury Cathedral, composer of one of our songs. These were the kind of people described as Moseley's thugs. One of our best speakers was Jim Shepherd, organiser of the Islington branch, to which I transferred in 1939. I remember Moseley addressing a meeting there, soon after the declaration of war, asking us to continue our efforts to secure peace with honour. This I did, taking part in demonstrations and paper selling, but the going became tough. I was slashed with a razor, had pepper thrown in my eyes, and suffered several vicious physical assaults. In January 1940, I joined the army and became a machine gunner, Lewis, 1915 vintage, in the Royal Engineers. 4 months later, we were fighting a desperate rearguard action through France and Belgium. My political comrades seemed a world away, yet, unbeknownst to me, and quite incredibly, a large number of them were very close indeed. These were the members of our Bethnal Green, Bow, Limehouse, Shoreditch and Stoke Newington branches, who from 1936 on had joined the 1st Battalion of the Rifle Brigade as regulars, and the 1st Battalion of the Queen Victoria Rifles as territorials, in such numbers that one of these became nicknamed in consequence the Blackshirt Battalion. After the German armoured divisions had cut the British Expeditionary Force's lines of communication, four battalions of riflemen, under the command of Brigadier C.N. Nicholson, were dispatched to Calais with orders to establish a supply route to Dunkirk. By then, the speed of the German advance had made it impossible to establish a route, and Brigadier Nicholson received orders to defend the port instead. The Queen Victoria's Rifles was the first battalion to arrive on the 22nd of May. On Friday, the 24th, German infantry and the tanks of two panzer divisions attacked, supported by low-level dive bombers. By 5 p.m. on the Sunday, the 1st Battalion of the Rifle Brigade was lost to the last man. The QVR's casualties were 116 officers and men. News of this Thermopylae-like tragedy eventually reached the political prisoners in Peveril internment camp on the Isle of Man, where Charles F. Watts, BUF branch organiser for the St. George's Division of Westminster, recorded it in these words. One of the four battalions that held the Germans at Calais long enough to enable the main body of troops to evacuate, in one of the most heroic rearguard actions of the war, was practically 100% blackshirt members recruited from East End districts. By the vital part they played in delaying the German advance for 4 days, our young blackshirt dead helped to make possible the ensuing miracle of Dunkirk. In so bravely sacrificing their lives for their country, they had also given the most convincing answer to those who at that very moment were dubbing us traitors and fifth columnists. After my evacuation from Dunkirk and returned to England, I discovered that many of my friends had been imprisoned. I kept in touch with them as best I could, spending the rest of my army life as a trade instructor at Chatham, until I was invalided out towards the end of 1944 for being C3, the result of getting in the way of an unfriendly missile in Belgium in 1940. Though some of the Brixton prison warders were reputed to have sheltered beneath Moseley's cell whenever there was an air raid in the naive belief that the Luftwaffe would be careful to avoid dropping bombs on him, the Germans showed no such scruples about bombing the precise areas of East London in which we enjoyed widespread support and where for years Moseley's meetings had attracted enthusiastic audiences of tens of thousands. Whole families of BUF members and supporters were wiped out in Limehouse, Bethnal Green, Bow and Hackney in the heavy raids of 7th to the 8th of September 1940, when 600 day and night bombers and fighters attacked the East End over a 12-hour period and in the assaults that continued without remit for 57 nights. In Bethnal Green alone, where we had more than 1,000 members, some 80 tons of bombs were dropped, and there was enormous damage and loss of life in Hackney, where our two branches, Hackney Central and Hackney South, each had many hundreds of members. During the month of September, 5,730 people were killed and almost 10,000 injured. Further, great raids continued until the 10th of May, 1941. By the war's end, a grievously large number of our members, civilians as well as servicemen, were dead. Whatever the future political climate might be, the voices of many of the British Union of Fascists' bravest and best, and Britain's bravest and best, had been silenced forever. By Patrick O'Donoghan. I'll just add here at the end that also Germany's bravest and best were silenced forever. And a large portion of the rest of the European nations were silenced forever in a completely needless brothers' war engineered by the Jews. As you are all well aware, I am sure.
You're tuned in to Radio Storm.